legend and literature has sprung from this single paradox, that the hands that made the sun and stars were too small to reach the huge heads of the cattle. Upon this paradox, all the literature of our faith was founded. It is something too good to be true, except that it is true.
Modern intellectuals have used a strange doctrine of doubt to attack the Christian faith. What they don't realize, however, is that they have actually attacked the facts as much as the faith. Hello, I'm Dale Ahlquist, and welcome to the Apostle of Common Sense, a series of programs where we explore the words and wisdom of the great English writer, G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton's book, The Everlasting Man, was written in 1925, and it is certainly one of his most important works. C.S. Lewis called it the best book of Christian apologetics that he'd ever read. In fact, C.S. Lewis was an atheist before he read the book, but he wasn't afterwards. And yet, The Everlasting Man is not really a book of apologetics at all. It is a sweeping history of the world. The fact that it also provides a well-reasoned defense of Christianity is only because Chesterton clearly shows who is the central figure in all of history. He begins by explaining that the critics of Christianity have no real perspective to their doubts. Their criticism, he says, has taken on a curious tone, as of random and illiterate heckling. They will complain and explain that churches are empty without going there to find out if they are empty or which of them are empty. They will condemn the church for condemning sin and then turn around and claim that since the world has become so evil and hopeless, it proves that the church is wrong.
When the world goes wrong, it proves rather that the church is right. The church is justified, not because her children do not sin, but because they do.
Chesterton says that the main problem with the critics of the church is that they are too close to it to see it. They cannot see the big picture, only the small picture that may affect them. With their sulks and their perversity and their petty criticism, they are merely reacting to the church. They are too close, not able to see it for what it really is. What they need to do is back up. The purpose of this book is to get the reader to back up far enough to see the thing, the Christian faith, from a truly objective viewpoint. Then he might see the thing that it is what it claims to be. It is exactly when the boy gets far enough off to see the giant that he sees he is really a giant. It is exactly the same when we see the Christian church from afar, that we see it really is the Church of Christ. The book was written as a kind of rebuttal to H.G. Wells' popular book, The Outline of History. Wells completely glosses over the two biggest points in his outline of history. The first is the creature called man, and the second is the man called Christ. Any honest historian will admit that man stands apart from all the other creatures and that Christ stands apart from all other men. But Wells treated man as just another animal and Christ as just another man. And of course, most modern historians have followed Wells' lead. So Chesterton begins with the man in the cave, literally, the caveman. The Darwinians see this figure as a descendant of ape-like beasts, with the caveman being little more than an ape himself. But Chesterton argues that Darwin's theory about the origin of man has not been proven, even though it is treated as if it were. It has even been turned into an article of faith. Yet not only is it based on scant evidence, elaborate reconstructions based on bits of bone and teeth. But if you dare to question the evidence, you will be faced with fierce ridicule.
Sometimes the professor with his bone becomes almost as dangerous as a dog with his bone. They talk of searching for the habits and habitat of the missing link, as if one were to talk of being on friendly terms with the gap in a narrative, or the whole in an argument, of taking a walk with a non sequitur, or dining with an undistributed middle.
Chesterton insists that the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of man, are all things shrouded in mystery. We cannot possibly imagine how the world was created any more than we could create one.
The real problem with evolution is that it is mistaken for an explanation. It has the fatal quality of leaving on many minds the impression that they understand it, just as many of them live under the illusion that they have read The Origin of the Species.
So what do we know about the man in the cave? The one thing we really do know about the caveman is that he was an artist. He left behind his drawings on the wall of the cave, where they're still available for viewing. The creature who made these drawings was truly different from all the other creatures, because he was a creator as well as a creature. Says Chesterton, "Art is the signature of man." It is just one of the many things which demonstrates that the more we look at man as an animal, the less he will look like one.
The simplest truth about man is that he is a very strange being, almost in the sense of being a stranger on this earth. He has much more of the external appearance of one bringing alien habits from another land than of a mere growth on this one. He has an unfair advantage and an unfair disadvantage. He cannot sleep in his own skin. He cannot even trust his own instincts. He is at once the creator moving miraculous hands and fingers, and yet he is a kind of cripple. He is wrapped in artificial bandages called clothes. He is propped on artificial crutches called furniture. His mind has the same doubtful liberties and the same wild limitations. Alone among the animals, he is shaken with the beautiful madness called laughter. Alone among the animals, he blushes with the mystery of shame. Whether we praise these things as natural to men, or abuse them as artificial in nature, they remain in the same sense unique. This is realized by the whole popular instinct called religion.
Those who try to explain religion only try to explain it away. They try to use our longing for God as evidence that there is no God, as if hunger were evidence that there's no such thing as food. Religion is as old as civilization, and civilization is as old as history. Chesterton says that when we study history, the curtain rises on a play that is already in progress. And he argues that it was religion that advanced civilization. It was religion that dealt with the meanings of things, with the development and interpretation of symbols, which advanced communication and knowledge, or what we call the arts and the sciences.
A politician once told me in a debate that I was resisting modern reforms exactly as some ancient priest probably resisted the discovery of the wheel. I replied that it was far more likely that the ancient priest made the discovery of the wheel. And it is overwhelmingly probable that the same ancient priest had a great deal to do with the discovery of the art of writing.
Chesterton speculates that most ancient tribes were initially monotheistic. They believed in only one god. But as tribes combined into larger cities, they combined their gods as well. There was, of course, one notable exception, the Jews. Other historians try to paint the Jewish God as something narrow. Chesterton says this God turned out to be only as narrow as the universe. The Jews protected and preserved the greatest truth of ancient times. He says, "The world owes God to the Jews." The religions of most other ancient peoples were less about theology than about mythology. Their heavens became populated with gods as frail as themselves. Mythology is about the imagination, that is, it's about the images that fill the mind. Chesterton says they are infinitely suggestive, And we all know what they suggest, until some scholar tells us. We know that the myths are stories about an ache for the eternal, especially an ache for eternal life. The ancient myths may be heroic, but they are ultimately hopeless. Orpheus can't quite bring back Eurydice from the dead. The myths are not able to answer the riddles that they raise. And when people realize their hopelessness, their society begins to collapse. If you study any civilization, you see that after progress comes decay. Chesterton says, "Men do not grow tired of evil, but of good. They become weary of joy. They stop worshiping God and start worshiping idols, their own bad imitations of God. And they become as wooden as the thing they worship. They start worshiping nature and become unnatural. They start worshiping sex and become perverted. Men start lusting after men and become unmanly."
The most ignorant of humanity know by the very look of earth that they have forgotten heaven.
But then, something marvelous happens in history, and it also happens in a cave in Bethlehem. Chesterton calls Bethlehem a place where extremes meet. It is where heaven meets earth. God comes to make a home in the world and finds himself homeless. And religion and philosophy come together for the first time. The kings and shepherds kneel down together before a manger in Bethlehem. Men of different lands, different cultures, different tastes and educations and aspirations all find what they are looking for in the same thing. The shepherds find their shepherd, and the kings find their king. The coming of the man called Christ changes everything. It is a story like none other. We have forgotten how unique, how strange and startling it really is. Remember, the purpose of this book, The Everlasting Man, is to get us to look at the claims of the Christian faith as a true outsider might. Chesterton says, if we approach the gospel objectively, we will see that it is not a book of platitudes. It paints a picture of a man who was indeed a wonder worker, but who spoke in riddles and rebukes. His teachings were as difficult to accept in his own time as they are today. None of the critics of Christianity seem to appreciate the fact that Christ's teachings were not dependent on the social order in which he lived, but transcended their time altogether.
The truth is that when the critics have spoken of the local limitations of the Galilean, it has always been a case of the local limitations of the critics.
The critics, of course, try to create a different Christ from the one portrayed in the Gospels by picking and choosing whatever they want. They always try to make him merely human, whether they make him a socialist or a pacifist or a madman. Chesterton says, "There must surely have been something not only mysterious but many-sided about Christ, if so many smaller Christs can be carved out of him." But the main impression one gets from studying the teachings of Christ is that he really did not come to teach. What separates Christianity from other religions is that its central figure does not wish to be known merely as a teacher. He makes the greatest claim of all. Muhammad did not claim to be God. Buddha did not claim to be God. Christ did claim to be God. But the story gets stranger still. It is indeed, as Chesterton calls it, the strangest story in the world. All of Christ's life is a steady pursuit towards the ultimate sacrifice. The gospel tells the story in plain words. Every attempt to amplify that story has diminished it. As Jesus is murdered, he prays for all the murderous race of men and asks that they be forgiven, for they know not what they do.
All the great groups that stood about the cross represent in one way or another the great historical truth of the time, that the world could not save itself. Man could do no more. Rome and Jerusalem and Athens and everything else were going down like a sea turned into a slow cataract.
The strength of the world was turned to weakness, and the wisdom of the world was turned to folly.
The wisdom of the world was turned to folly, because who would have thought that the local execution of a minor revolutionary in an obscure outpost would become the central event in all of history? But that is where the cross stands, at the center of history. Pretty serious. So naturally, Chesterton takes the opportunity to make one of his great puns. He says, "The cross is the crux of the matter." Chesterton goes on to say that this central dogma of the Christian faith, that God died, that God was for one instant forsaken of God, that God sacrificed himself to himself, is more mysterious than anything, even the mystery of creation itself. And those who object to this dogma do so not because the dogma is bad, but because it's too good to be true. What they really reject is the freedom that fills the Christian creed. They reject the dogma that gives man so much freedom as to allow him to fall. They reject the dogma that gives God so much freedom as to allow him to die. They reject the dogma as the truth because the truth would set them free. But the gospel story does not end with God's death. It ends with the most startling episode of all, an empty grave, and God again walking in a garden as on the first day of creation. The gospel story ends not with an ending, but with a beginning. It is the beginning of the church.
Christianity appeared as a church, with everything that is implied in a church, and much that is disliked in a church. It did not begin as an ethical movement or a school of idealists. It began as a church. It had a doctrine and a discipline. It had sacraments and rituals. It admitted people and expelled people. It affirmed dogma with authority and rejected false teaching the same way.
Chesterton says Christianity did what no other religion had done. It met the mythological search for romance by being a story, and the philosophical search for truth by being a true story. The more we study it, the more we see that Christianity is truly different from every other religion, just as man is truly different from every other creature. The church carried a unique message, and it puzzled the world that its members acted like messengers. They even called their message the gospel, the good news. But as Chesterton says, nobody else except those messengers has any gospel. Nobody else has any good news, for the simple reason that nobody else has any news at all.
The creed is like a key. First, the key is above all things a thing with a shape. It is a thing that depends entirely upon keeping its shape. The Christian creed is above all things the philosophy of shapes and the enemy of shapelessness. It differs from the formless infinity of Buddhism and the changing vagueness of evolutionism. A man told that his solitary latchkey has been melted down with a million others into a Buddhistic unity would be annoyed. A man told that his key was gradually growing and sprouting in his pocket, branching into new complications, would not be more gratified. Second, the shape of the key is both fantastic and arbitrary. It is not a matter of argument. It either fits the lock or it does not. It is useless for men to stand around disputing about it. It is futile to reconstruct it on pure principles of geometry or decorative art. It is senseless for a man to say he would like a simpler key. It would be far more sensible to ask for a crowbar. When people complain of the religion being so complicated with theology and such, they forget that the world is complicated. It is full of secrets, of
of unexplored and unfathomable fallacies, of unconscious mental diseases, dangers in all directions. If the faith had faced the world only with platitudes about peace and simplicity, it would not have had the faintest effect on that lunatic asylum that is the world. The key may seem complex, but there is one thing about it that is simple. It opens the door.
We sometimes hear it said that Christianity shook the world. But Chesterton says that Christianity did not shake the world, it steadied the world. It has endured for 2,000 years. And the world within the church has been more lucid, more level-headed, more reasonable in its hopes, more healthy in its instincts, more humorous and cheerful in the face of fate and death than all the world outside. The soul of Christendom, he says, is common sense. Christianity has done something different than just survive. It has defeated its enemies by following the example of Christ. Not just by saying the right thing and doing the right thing, not by marvels and not by might, but by resurrection, by returning to life after having been apparently defeated. As Chesterton says, Christianity has died many times and risen again, for it had a God who knew the way out of the grave. I'm Dale Ahlquist. Join us again on The Apostle of Common Sense.